Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show, two artists, visionaries who also appreciate nature on the show. Paul Demaret, who is an artist, but also, I guess we could say, enthralled with butterflies, is going to join us.
Yeah, I read about him in Horticulture magazine and, of course, had great pictures. And he's a man that grew up and learned to work with pastels and then learned to work with butterflies. And he would sit out there in his field and do both, really. And he ended up creating gardens just for certain butterflies. And just an interesting concept, I think, especially in January when you're just kind of looking forward to some color and brightness and art and happiness.
And you need to get organized for the spring to do some planning on your sustainable garden for this year, right?
Yeah, the other thing is there's a phrase I've always stuck with is, I like what I lack. I really believe that. And I like to write, and I have no talent whatsoever.
Oh, yes, you do.
Using my hands.
Oh, okay. Maybe that.
Right, thank you.
You write well, but the other stuff maybe not.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Okay,
yeah.
I hear you.
I like what I lack, but I'm not able to draw or paint or even do topiary very well.
But so you appreciate it even more so because you can't do
exactly
it well. Yeah.
Exactly. And these two guys really are quite a combination.
Yeah, I think Pearl Fryer is also going to join us on the show. He has literally a world-famous topiary garden in Bishopville, South Carolina now. But, I mean, he's like the quintessential how art, nature, and unbridled expression and enthusiasm all sort of converge in one powerful person, you know? Not only artistic ideas and expression, but also how that can impact the community and others too. But the garden started with his desire to win Yard of the Month way back in the early 1980s. So he started, just kind of happen chance, I guess, thought that like the topiary thing would really wow the people the most. And it's odd how things just kind of snowball. It's like baby steps. And then, 25 years later, he's famous and has recently had a documentary released on his life and his garden. So we're going to talk to Pearl today about how all of that unfolded over the years and, really his vision, not just for the topiary garden, but beyond. So we're looking forward to that. In the meantime, Bob, what is going on in your garden?
I'm worried about my baby azaleas. Well,
you had a drought a year last year.
Yeah, and I planted them last fall. We had this terrible cold spell here recently. And so I go out there and I look at them and I keep them watered because I think the first two or three years are really vital with those guys. And most of them look pretty good. But I go out, just as a message to other people, check those baby plants, particularly this winter when it's been up and down and cold and wet. And
coming off of a year that was droughty. Tough.
Yeah, and I think they're going to be okay, but I'm putting the water to them. I'm talking nice to them. I go out and pet them.
Give them some extra attention.
I will. So that's just a warning to anybody that's got plants that might need some help. Give them help.
Yeah, give them help.
About the wish you state. What's up?
I have been, you look for things to get you busy outside this time of the year. And as you said, this recent cold snap we have had, the ground's frozen and there's not so many things you can get done. So I think about cleanup, the bird feeders, you really should clean out those a couple times every year. So I'm cleaning out my bird feeders and then, of course, restocking them. I know that, did you get an electric warmer for your bird bath?
It's on my list.
Okay, because I've got all that stuff too, so I could get all that cleaned out. And then also, Bob, on the farm, we've got all kinds of different little nesting boxes for different kinds of birds. So, of course, we've got the bluebird boxes along the fence, but then we also have other kinds of nesting birdhouse things that are hanging in trees and in different places. So I go around and I clean those out this time of the year as well, because you want them nice and clean for when spring comes and everybody's ready to start to build a new nest. So don't forget about those house cleaning sorts of things out in nature. And now's a good time to do it.
It's OSHA approved.
Is OSHA approved indeed. So get out there and check it out. Another thing that you can check out during winter, tree identification is so difficult in the wintertime, don't you think?
Yes.
But Bernheim is having a program coming up January 31st, getting to know trees in winter. They'll teach you a little bit about tree identification, what to look for when there's no leaves on the trees, of course, and then talk about tree lore. So if you're interested in that, check out our website at wfpl.org or visit Bernheim's website.
And a lot of people will be surprised to learn how important trees and shrubs are to the whole butterfly world.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is a time of year, it may seem early to think about butterflies, but it's not too early to think about getting the right trees and plants mm-hmm. on order or mm-hmm. find a place in your yard to put them.
Yep.
And to help us with that, we're going to have Paul Demaray, a Tennessee artist who enjoys working in pastels and with butterflies. He's combined those two into a landscape art that encompasses both worlds, and he's here today to tell us all about it. Paul, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you.
Let's have some background first. Kind of tell us exactly where you live and how you developed as an artist, and then we'll go to the butterflies from there.
Well, I live right now in Kingsport, Tennessee, which is northeast Tennessee. But I grew up in Michigan, and I came out to Tennessee for the World's Fair that they had in Knoxville in 1982.
Wow. And never left, huh?
I've never left. I love that here.
Well, how did you develop as an artist? You're into pastels now. I'm always curious about, you know, I'm a writer, and I've always admired artists. Where does that come from?
I've always drawn. I went to art school, and my father gave me a set of pastels, and I started to do portraits. I just really love pastels. They kind of suited my temperament, so I kind of stuck to that, and I've kind of stuck to it ever since.
So how does that translate in the landscape?
Well, I don't use my butterfly knowledge specifically in my artwork,
mm-hmm.
but I do when I'm out, you know, painting. I work now, I'm working more from digital photographs that I take, but for 25 years I was out, I would just go out and sit in the field and find a spot. It's always just been fun for me, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, Paul, what fascinated me about the horticulture story was the very specific plants for the very specific butterflies. I know a lot about monarchs, a little about monarchs. I didn't realize you could plant wild cherry seedlings to provide food for the caterpillars for the red-spotted purples.
Yeah. Red-spotted purple, if you have watched them, they hardly ever will lay eggs on a big tree. Almost always looking for some little sapling that has fresh growth on it.
Ah.
So I have these little... It's kind of a wild cherry is kind of a trash tree here,
right? Mm-hmm.
And these little trees will pop up and up, and I just sort of let them grow for a while, then I cut them back, so they always have new growth on them.
Hmm.
And those butterflies will, the female will, they'll kind of cruise through your yard, and they will see them and fly around, and they usually lay the eggs right on the tips of the leaves.
So, okay, it's little seedlings, good for egg laying. What about the, you know, so often we talk about the nectar producing plants and the food
yeah.
that different species of butterfly need. And we know that some butterfly are like plant specific. So
yeah.
can you give us some examples of different plants that are specific to different species of butterflies?
Well, down in Tennessee, the pawpaw tree is the specific food plant for the zebra swallowtail.
Huh.
They really don't use any other food plant but that. So if you have that butterfly in your range, if you plant a pawpaw tree, you know, they're going to target it out,
mm-hmm.
and you'll have that butterfly there. But that's one a really beautiful butterfly that, you know, if you get a pawpaw tree started in your yard, they'll find your yard.
I think the black swallowtail, an important lesson, because so often the caterpillar stage, people find it in their herb gardens and they think that this caterpillar is going to voraciously eat all of their herbs, but in fact that beautiful butterfly comes from that voracious eater.
Yeah.
Talk about what we need to look for so that we don't destroy a soon-to-be butterfly in our
yeah.
garden.
Well, I think a lot of people don't really understand the basic butterfly life cycle. The black swallowtail is a very beautiful caterpillar. It's very noticeable. You know, if you have any plant in that family, parsley or fennel or dill, you're likely to see that butterfly eating your herb, that particular family of herbs, but no other ones. They're not going to get on your oregano or
mm-hmm.
hop over to your mint or something like that. They're only going to take plants in that family. Economically, butterflies have very little damage. It's only the cabbage butterfly, the familiar white
mm-hmm.
butterfly, that will get your cabbage, and it'll eat a whole host of different plants. And it's just a kind of an ordinary kind of a green caterpillar that you're not likely to notice. But I think people just need to be tolerant, and we have sort of the Roundup philosophy on our lungs. A lot of gardeners, too. You know, if it's a bug or it crawls or
right.
you want to you want to get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to have a successful butterfly garden, you have to kind of leave things alone a little bit more.
So what do you tell people to see a caterpillar on their fennel or dill or just leave it alone?
I do, yeah. Or I tell them that it's going to be a beautiful butterfly, black swallowtail.
Mm-hmm. So once it's a butterfly, okay, the caterpillar stage is going to eat the foliage, right?
Yeah.
But once it's a butterfly, it enjoys the nectar from blossoms. So can you talk a little bit about some of the best flowering plants to have in our gardens for butterflies?
Well, I think that the, probably the most successful one is buddleia, the butterfly bush, because it blooms for a long period. It has berries. It's very sweet. And you'll have a lot of butterflies on it, but they love, they like zinnias really well.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good annual. They like purple cone flowers. You'll see a lot of them on that Magnus.
The good old-fashioned variety, yeah.
Beautiful, and it stays in bloom for a long time, and you'll see it's covered with butterflies. So those are probably, you know, my favorites.
Well, Paul, I'm planting a butterfly garden this year specifically because I bought a big butterfly, yellow butterfly chair. I thought it'd be kind of fun.
Yeah.
But I'm worried about early on in the year, like, a lot of these are perennials. What can I plant for April and May to draw butterflies, or are they even out at that time of year?
Yeah. Well, like the monarch, for instance, it's usually coming back from migration in early April. Normally, when the females come back, they're really kind of old and tattered, and the plants are barely out of the ground, and they're looking around really vigorously for milkweed and not usually finding it. When I was raising a lot of monarchs, I had a certain trick. I would grow this tropical milkweed. It's not hardy. I would grow it indoors, and I'd have a good stand of it, and I'd get it out there, and the butterflies would just lay eggs all over it because it was really ready to go. But in April and May, it's tough. The butterfly season is later.
And I guess that's when they, too, would sort of more rely on flowering trees, huh?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I think a lot of people don't realize what the butterfly food plants are. Like, most of the food plants are what we would call weeds, very occasionally herbs, but not that often. So I like to encourage people to leave a sort of a weedy area, or if they have a little woodsy area, just kind of let it go and kind of leave it alone, and you'll have a lot more food plant opportunities for the butterflies there. And that will help the early season butterflies. But really, butterfly season, when you see the most numbers of butterflies, is usually August, September, July. When it gets really hot, butterflies love it hot.
Mm-hmm. So, Paul, do we have any butterflies that winter over, you know, say in Tennessee, say in Kentucky, without migrating somewhere else?
There's a certain group that actually will spend the winter in hollow trees and cans and things like that, under logs. There's a group with it that includes the mourning cloak, one called the question mark, one called the comma, related butterfly.
I've seen
And these butterflies actually have a little bit of ethylene glycol in their bodies, but they will stay totally dormant, and on a warm day they might come out and fly a little bit, but they will spend the whole winter as an adult, and some butterflies will spend the whole winter as a chrysalis, and other ones just move south to warmer climate.
So I guess to sustain all of those, have a little wild area and then some strategically placed flowering trees, annuals
early,
and perennials and herbs.
And some very early milkweed if you can get it.
That's right.
Very
Sounds
early
good.
Milkweed would be good. Now, one thing that's kind of interesting is that the orange milkweed,
butterfly
plant
weed
that everybody talks about, the monarchs don't like that plant. It's only if there's absolutely no other kind of milkweed will they use it.
Mm-hmm. They like the white kind.
They like the regular big leaf milkweed the best.
Yeah.
And they'll also somewhat take that pink swamp milkweed, but they love the tropical milkweed.
Ah.
That stuff is.
I'm going to look for that beginning tomorrow.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Well, Paul, thank you. I enjoyed consulting with you on butterflies and your art.
Thank you.
Paul Demaray is a Tennessee artist who enjoys working in pastels and with butterflies. For more information on Paul or butterflies, Visit the homegrown page at WFPL.org.
After the break, the topiary garden of Pearl Fryer. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And a totally fabulous story, Pearl Fryer. People may have heard of him. I've heard of him before. I just didn't know that much detail.
Yeah, I did too. I forget where, but it sure stuck in my mind, the story itself.
Yeah, Bishopville, South Carolina, past 25 years, he's been working, self-taught topiary artist, and, you know, has transformed his three-acre lot around his home outside of Bishopville into literally a work of art.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
And he's also transforming other lives in the process, yeah, which is really another really great part of the story.
It really is, all around. So we're excited to have Pearl on the show today. Pearl Fryer is an internationally recognized topiary artist living and working in Bishopville, South Carolina. He started his work around his home back in 1984, an attempt to be recognized as the Yard of the Month by the local garden club there, Bob. How about that? And then it turns into something amazing. Yeah. What has happened since is truly fabulous. Pearl's been featured in art and garden magazines, on television, and most recently in a feature-length documentary titled A Man Named Pearl. His topiary work has been in museum exhibitions. It's seen in municipal landscapes and commissioned gardens. And Pearl is artist-in-residence at Coker College and a popular speaker as he relates the art of topiary to fine art. Pearl, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
Great. Your story is really a fabulous story, and it all started back in the early 1980s. What happened that set you on the path of topiary and art on the 3 acres around your home in Bishopville?
I came to Bishopville from New York, Atlanta, to help start up an operation for the company I worked for in New York, which was National Can. And once I got here, it was about 4 years, 3 years, I guess, and I decided to stay because I'm only 150 miles from my original home.
Oh, yeah?
In North Carolina.
Uh-huh.
And I decided to create this garden. I came out and I bought this piece of property. It was a lot. And it was a cornfield.
Mm-hmm.
And it was outside the city limits, so I decided to create this garden from a creative point of view because I didn't have a horticulture background or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to work, and my goal was to try to get Yard of the Month.
Yeah.
And because I was outside the city limits, they didn't want to give it to me because they didn't want to start giving Yard of the Month all over the county for city dwellers.
Right.
And so then I said, well, you know, I got to make them make an exception. Oh, I got to come up with something that would cause them to make an exception.
Uh-huh.
So I went to a nursery, and he had a plant that was cut into two tiers, the two balls.
Yeah.
So I was going to buy it and put it in front of my house. And he says, you know, he found out I knew nothing about gardening. And so he says, I really don't want to sell it to you. He said, because people come in, they buy these plants, and they think they grow like that. He said, but I'll show you how to do it. So he went out, found a plant. And he gave me a 3-minute lesson how to cut the two balls or the two tiers. And over a period of time, I took the 3-minute lesson and turned it into what I've created today.
Yeah, You sure have. So you're self-taught, obviously, after the 3-minute lesson.
Right.
Over the years, Pearl, has it been a sort of trial and error or through experimentation? I mean, you know, how does the self-taught thing sort of unfold?
Well, I think it was more or less my success with what I have accomplished was because of the lack of knowledge.
Uh-huh.
If I had had a horticulture background, there's no way I would have attempted it. Because my friends and all that had a horticulture background, they would say to me, you know, you can't do that, you can't do this, that plant won't do. Well, see, I didn't know that. And my idea was that I felt that I could make the plant do what I could dream up or the image that I could create in my mind, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I just went to work. I used PVC pipe, if I could imagine the image, I created it with plants. That's exactly what it is. And one of the reasons I get so much attention for my style of topiary is the fact that mine is not based on animals, geometric figures, teapots.
Right.
Because when you think of topiary, it's what you think of, Disney World. You
right.
think of, but I'm more of an abstract, free-flowing skeleton. I like that real skeleton look.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime I go in to work with the plant, that's what I want to create. I want to be able to see the trunk, the stems, complemented by free-flowing lines of foliage.
Hmm.
And that's it.
Well, Pearl, looking back on your early life before this, was there anything or any person that might have influenced you into trying art like this? It was just totally go for it.
No, the only thing was that I've always been creative. I knew that from the time I was a kid. We used to make, my brother and I would make our toys. We'd make this. We'd make things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And even on my job, there were instances where I would use my creative ability to draw attention to myself because I could come up with something totally different, but to the same point that someone else is doing. And in the final analysis, it's all about drawing attention to yourself for something that you do well,
mm-hmm.
You see? And so that is exactly what I tried to do, and that's what I wanted to do. But then I also wanted to show that sometimes we have a tendency to judge all students from an academic point of view. And for that reason, sometimes we're losing a lot of kids that's gifted in other areas and might be average student academically.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And because we only focus on the academic aspect of education, then these students lose interest. And because of testing, by the time a student is in the sixth grade, they have accepted the fact that they cannot achieve at a certain level. And by the time in the 10th grade, a lot of students drop out. And once they drop out, they fall through the cracks. And it's only because sometimes, and I'm only talking from experience because I was one of those kids that wasn't supposed to make it, is that the attention is paid to what they would do well. If they had been tested in their strength,
mm-hmm.
then
right.
they would have made 14 or 1500. And the person that made 14 or 1500 from an academic point of view, say on the SAT test, would have made 1,000. You see what I mean? And
yeah.
so that was really my goal, to show what can be accomplished by using what you have. Because in the final analysis, education is about developing what you do well.
Mm-hmm.
And you show me anyone that work at anything with a passion, then I'm going to show you a person that's going to succeed at what they're doing. And once they get it to the point that they work a cut above average, and thinking outside the box, then they become a master of what they do. If you ever hear someone says, the book says, and they always are working from the book, then that means that the person, they're never going to get credit for what they do because the person that wrote the book got credit for that. So that's my whole goal, and that's what the movie was built around.
Mm-hmm. Well, Pearl, have you been able to take that to schools or school kids to your place to preach that to them?
Yeah, I teach a course at Coker College, and what I try to teach is how to use your creative ability. They had me to come in for a semester as an artist in residence. I was there for like 3 years. I didn't sign a contract last year. Probably will this year. And that, I taught it through the art department, and now I do presentations all over the country at universities, schools, and that kind of thing. Talking about, you know, what can be accomplished by using what you have.
So it's not necessary. I mean, that's what's, I think, nice about your story, Pearl, because it's not just about the art. And you, and clearly, you know, you had said it before, it's not Disney World. Your topiaries are not figurative forms. They're more abstract in nature. They're, you know, considered more artistic. So you're able to sort of marry the two, the natural artistic part of it, along with inspiring people to be creative in their own right.
Yeah, because what I said to you, even in my presentation, especially to students, you may never cut a plant, but I want to show you what I accomplished by using plants as my media for my expression.
Okay.
You might be you could be a mechanic. You might be a chef. So there's so many things that you can do with creativeness.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the real problems with being creative is that these are students sometimes, because more than likely they are average students. We'll say C students. And All of the help goes to the top. Mm-hmm. No scholarship for the bottom. And what happened when this student cannot afford their talent? You see, I was 40 years old when I got to the point I could afford my talent.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I had it all. I knew it was there. But, I mean, I could not afford it. But what would have happened if someone would say, this person has a special gift, so we should make sure the financial resources are there for him as much so it is for that student that's making A's and B's.
Mm-hmm.
You see?
Yeah.
But that's what the whole idea of what I do. That's the mm-hmm. whole. I don't know if you saw the movie, but that's part of the movie.
Not yet, but we will. I did see it at the video store, at the rental store, so I know it's available. So, Pearl, let's talk a little bit more about how you personally accomplish your vision with your topiary. Folks really need to go to our website so they can see images of Pearl's work because it's quite amazing. And, you know, the essence of topiary, I think, is patience, Pearl, is it not? you know, how long does it take, if we look at one of your mature pieces, how long has it been for that to actually materialize in that vision that you talk about seeing straight away?
Somewhere around 5 to 7 years.
Okay.
The most, I would say, I have pieces somewhere like 20, 25 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
And it took about 7 years to create that. Most pieces, the smaller pieces, 3 to 5 years, 5 to 7 years, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because you must start with small plants. You cannot start with a plant that's already woody, because you cannot cut into the plant.
Mm-hmm.
But you start with a very small plant, maybe 1 gallon, 3 gallon container size plant, right? And you go from there. Mm-hmm. And I have pieces that was, say, 2 feet tall when I started. And when I finished them, they were like 20, 25 feet tall. And it took approximately 7 years to do it.
Now, what's the maintenance on those? How often do you have to go out and prune them and what time of the year?
Usually, if there's some type of holly, it's basically every 4 to 6 weeks. If you prune a plant, and once you finish pruning, you have to rake the clippings. You waited too late to prune.
Oh.
So that means, because, see, I'm environmental conscious, so I don't use chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
So I use a lot of mulch. So once I prune my plant, all I do is take my blower and blow it up under the plant.
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes part of the nutrient for mm-hmm. my plant.
Mm-hmm. How many hours a week are you out there pruning?
Well, you know, it's a continuous job.
Oh.
I mean, in other words, I'm out there all the time, you know. And my garden now is, it's a full-time operation. But it's being looked at as from a preservation point of view now, so maybe yeah. some help is going to come along.
Now, I've tried topiary with limited results. Do you find some plants fight you? They don't want to be a box. They don't want to be free form. They want to be something else than you got in mind?
No, I never had a problem with that, because I work with plants that, from the time I started, my goal is to accomplish what I want to from that plant, because the plant has to grow,
mm-hmm.
and in that process, you try to create what you want to create, and so far I don't see how it damaged the plant,
mm-hmm.
right?
You know, because I work with pine trees, oak trees. I even got blue spruce, Norwegian spruce, Canadian spruce. I even have plants that shouldn't even grow in the area. and I got a topiary, you know.
Right.
Tell him it can't be done and he'll do it. What are your tools, Pearl?
I basically use just a gas-powered hedge trimmer.
Okay.
I started with hand, electric, and gas.
Mm-hmm.
In England, everything is done by hand. Mm-hmm. I mean, they'll build scaffolds around a plant.
Mm-hmm.
And you might have a whole crew working on one plant. Well, you know, I would take the same plant and prune it within, say, 4 or 5 hours, and they got 5 or 6 people working on it.
Mm-hmm.
But these are real masters at what they do.
Yeah. So, you know, some of these that are super tall, I mean, do you use, like, a bucket to get up there to the top, a big ladder, or what?
The movie, it was all done from ladders, right?
Mm-hmm.
And because people saw the movie, they became concerned about the safety
uh-huh.
element, right? And the Garden Conservancy, they voted to take this garden on as a preservation project. And they rented the movie, they flew into Charlotte, North Carolina, and came to visit my garden in Bishopville, and they rented the movie, and viewed the movie from Charlotte to Bishopville.
Uh-huh.
And once they got here, they said, "Listen, you need a cherry picker because at your age,
get that man off that
time,
ladder."
I was like 68.
Uh-huh.
They said, "You're gonna fall and break your neck." So it took them about 10 minutes to raise enough money to buy me a cherry picker that
awesome.
Reached about 45 feet.
How wow. old are you now, Pearl?
69.
69, all right.
And so this will be the first year that I will have a safe means of pruning plants 30 to 35 feet tall.
Awesome.
Yeah, Pearl, another delightful thing about your garden is you add art, pieces of art, in the fabric of it. Talk about that, where you get them and how you place them.
Well, I actually call it junk art,
mm-hmm.
and I have a pile of junk, and when I need a piece, fountains or whatever, I just pull it out and make a piece to fit the area which I want to place it, and it's been on exhibitions all over the country. It amazes me because what I think is so simple, because I mean anyone can go out and pull out junk and take it to a welding shop and said, "Weld this for me, put this here and do this and do that." And then I bring it home and it's so well accepted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I've had instances where the museum would come in and just clean out my yard and do an exhibition on my junk art.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
And it really began with the State Museum. I mean, they did a show called Still Worth Keeping. And that's with the first time that I realized maybe I do just something a little different, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they included me in this exhibition, and it's been kind of snowballing ever since.
Yeah. So, Pearl, what kind of impact has that had on the community of Bishopville?
Well, it's a major part of the community. I mean, mm-hmm. I get a lot of tourists. The days I get 200 people come through.
Mm-hmm.
There's always people here from every day.
Mm-hmm.
There are people come from all over the world. Like within the last couple of weeks, I had people from France, England, just name a country, Russia, you know, people actually come just to see the garden, or they come to the country, they've heard of the garden,
mm-hmm.
and they come by and they walk through it, you know, because I think it's mainly because people appreciate uniqueness, and I also think in the final analysis, people just cannot believe I was able to accomplish so much with one man operation.
Right.
And I think they're fascinated by that.
Uh-huh.
You know?
You knew you had the talent, Pearl, but are you still even surprised at the results, what's happened now, worldwide guests and visitors?
No, not really. Because you know what I think of? The number of students that would be in my category that what I do couldn't even touch them, and they're never going to become known about it.
Right.
You see what I mean?
Yes.
I mean, I am, my real passion, and I just gave my first scholarship within Lee County within the last month, and I give scholarships to C students. And these are students that feel that they have no place to go, that they're almost, I put it to you this way, the student that I awarded my scholarship to this semester. She's 22 years old, has two kids, and she wants to get a degree. So my goal is that if I can help save this one student, she's going to make a better life for her two kids, and we're going to save three people. That's my goal, and I'm here. I prove that you can be successful by using what you have, because I have no horticulture background,
mm-hmm.
and pretty well known as a tuber artist.
So, ultimately, Pearl, how long did it take you from planting that first topiary to winning the yard of the month?
Well,
do you remember?
I got serious with the garden around 1990.
Uh-huh.
We had Hugo in 89. And what plants I had out was so small, I got absolutely no damage.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
So that shows you what I had, you know, because I'd been working on a garden since 82, but it was a cornfield trying to get it together. And from 1990 to about 1995, 96, I won Yard of the Month. And it began to happen.
And it started to happen.
From Yard of the Month, local paper,
uh-huh.
to a major newspaper, then television show, local television show,
uh-huh.
to major television shows.
And is that when people started to come show interest in visiting the garden?
Yeah, people. Mm-hmm. The word had kind of gotten out locally. I would say even before I won Yard of the Month. But then once I won Yard of the Month, my second piece of publicity from the local paper was the Atlanta Constitution, mm-hmm. and Martha Tate did the article for the Atlanta Constitution. And while she was here, she said, "We're putting together this show called Garden Diary for HGTV, mm-hmm. and that's going to be a new garden show, and they're going to be tested in certain cities. Would you allow us to use your garden as a pilot for that show?" Mm-hmm. And I said, yes. And sure enough, a few years later, she came back, and that was the beginning of really major publicity, you know.
And you had mentioned that the garden was chosen for a preservation product of the Garden Conservancy, but you also have folks in Bishopsville, an organization, the Friends of Pearl Friars Topiary Garden. Can you talk about the kind of support now that, you know, will make sure that the garden goes on and on and on?
Well, see, what happened, the Garden Conservancy is out of New York, California. And this organization's goal is to preserve unused gardens. Mm-hmm. They don't preserve them. They come in and they set up an organization to help you create a foundation. And my foundation will be Friends of Pearl.
Okay, gotcha.
Okay, today, people that donate for the preservation of my garden, they donate Friends of Pearl / Conservancy, because we don't have our 501c yet, so we come under the umbrella mm-hmm. of the Garden Conservancy, because they're in the process of helping us organize and everything. Once we get our foundation to the point that we can move the funds from the umbrella, the Garden Conservancy, then it becomes our to manage or whatever, mm-hmm. because we don't have the resources now. They manage it for us. Mm-hmm. And so that's how the garden is being, because people are donating now for the preservation of the garden. That's why today I have a part-time helper, because they want me to start training someone.
Right, like an apprentice or something.
Before I get disabled, because it's one of these gardens that if you walk away from it 3 years mm-hmm. and decide, well, it was a garden in Bishopsville, want to come back and restore that garden, you don't restore this garden, it's gone.
Right. Yeah. I see. So tell us about the documentary. Who actually produced the documentary, A Man Named Pearl?
It was done by Scott Galloway out of Charlotte. What happened, he did a TV show. He's a TV person. And they did a show called Blue Ribbons. And they picked four gardens from the southeast. Brook Green Garden, Biltmore Housing Garden, mm-hmm. Bellinger Graff Garden out of Mobile, Alabama, and my garden was number four. Uh-huh. And the viewing audience was to vote on the best garden. So I didn't even bother to vote, because you had Brook Green Garden and Biltmore Housing Garden. And so they call me, whoever won, they come back and do a show and present you with the blue ribbon. And they called me one day and said, you won by 54%.
Wow.
So then they came back and they presented me with the blue ribbon. And they says to me, we'd like to do a movie, because we could not tell the story in 5 minutes. And I says, no, I really don't want to do a movie, because I don't think I have enough to do a movie about. And because just prior to that, I did a piece for CBS Sunday Morning.
Oh, yeah?
And it was like, I don't know, about a 3-minute, 4-minute piece. And I just couldn't see stretching that into an hour and 20-minute feature film. But then I didn't know what I was talking about. But anyway, they came back the third time and says, we got to raise the money and all that. Uh-huh. So I agreed. And that's how the movie came about.
Sounds good. Well, we'll be looking for it in the video shop for sure. Pearl, thank you so much. Your garden, surely a national treasure.
As is your philosophy, really.
Yeah.
And the reasons behind it are just wonderful.
Yeah. Thank you for your time.
And thank you for having me.
Uh-huh. Pearl Friar is an internationally recognized topiary artist. Over the last 25 years, Pearl has turned his 3-acre garden into a national treasure, and you can visit it year-round. It's located just off Interstate 20 outside of Bishopsville, South Carolina. You can also see more in the documentary, A Man Named Pearl. For more information on Pearl and his garden, please see our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, we peruse the catalogs for some interesting plants, plus another chapter in Bob's fabulous plant stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And the last couple of weeks, Bob and I have assigned one another catalog duty to, you know, find three interesting things as we peruse all the catalogs that are coming in the mail right now. It's one of those things to do in the wintertime that entertains us and gets us prepared for the spring.
Mandatory, in fact.
And you had ornamental grasses. So what were some interesting things you saw?
And I went through the Kurt Blumel catalog because they're always kind of cutting-edge stuff. But then I ended up going back to some old favorites I've always liked.
Yeah.
I think my favorite overall ornamental grass is featherweed grass.
Mm-hmm.
The Carl Forrester grass, they call it, it's another name. It's Calamagrostis is the Latin name for it. I like it because it's straight upright. It's about 4 or 5 feet tall, blooms early in the year with this kind of wheat seed head look to it that ripples in the wind. It's a great background plant or even individual clumps.
Yeah, and it'll tolerate a little bit of shade better than a lot of the other ones.
It's a neat grass. And there's also some variegated cultivars. The newer ones are Overdam and Avalanche. There's a gold one called El Dorado, which I haven't tried yet.
Of the feathery.
Feathery grass, yeah. Another one is the good old Pennisetum family, or the fountain grasses. I just like those, too. They're smaller, often kind of clumping. Some are even bushel basket-sized grasses. There's some dwarf ones called Hamlin and Little Bunny. I just like the names.
I like the Little Bunny one.
There's my Little Bunny out there. But they're very useful in the perennial border, I mean, for different effects, if you want lower kind of clumping grasses. There's also a new one there I noticed in the catalog called Wesser Bargland, which is kind of a lighter green, which is a nice, had a nice touch to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, there's another Pennisetum that everybody thinks is hardy here, and it's not. It's the purple fountain grass. And it's a big, bold, kind of purple, burgundy plant. Rubrum is the cultivar, and it's only hardy in zones 9 or 10. But I like it late summer, fall. There's this big explosion of color when nothing else is around. And there's a new cultivar out called Fireworks that's just sort of amazing. It's kind of ruby and burgundy and vivid colors in it. I'm looking forward to trying that. Again, it's an annual.
Good for containers.
Yes.
That bold statement in containers.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
And if it dies, so what?
Yeah.
You know, what
right.
the heck? How about the Wishy? What do you got going on?
All right. I had vegetables, and I'm going a little international on the vegetable thing. And some of these I've tried, some of these I haven't. But I want people to think of French filet beans, the true haricots, the really thin green bean that's so tender and delicious.
May we?
And then a Romanesco summer squash, like zucchini-like.
Comes
right?
with columns.
Romanesco. Italian, obviously.
That's Italian.
And then the Russian banana fingerling potato. All right?
All right.
So we've got France, Italy, and Russia represented.
Yeah.
Okay, so for the filet beans, the French true haricots, my very, very favorite, and you don't see it in a whole lot of catalogs. I've seen it in Wood Prairie catalog and then one other, and I can't remember which one it is now. Taverna.
Okay.
Taverna is a fabulous true haricots. There's also one called Triomphe de Farcy. There's one called Fan de Bagnol. I think. You know, all sort of French-sounding names. But look for French filet bean or haricot vert, which means green bean, essentially.
What makes it so much better?
They're just really thin and tender. There's not so much beanie in it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's mostly, you know, they're just really thin.
It makes a nice presentation, too.
And they're crisp, and you don't have to cook them very much. You can boil them really quickly, or you can just toss them in, you know, olive oil, like sauté them, and they're fabulous.
They don't serve
really,
in White
really
Castles, apparently.
No, they don't. I'll bring some for you this summer, because we always grow them. Okay, Romanesco, a zucchini, two varieties that are interesting, Portofino and Gadzooks. They're fluted, so when you cut them in slices, they almost look like little stars.
More presentation.
Okay, very nice. Very vigorous plant and doesn't seem to be as bothered by the squash vine borer.
Good.
Okay, so Romanesco types of zucchinis and then the Russian banana fingerling.
Let's hear it, comrade. What about that one?
Small little fingerling potato.
Ah.
Easy to grow, great taste in terms of just roasting potatoes.
How small is it?
It's like that
oh,
big.
Wow. Golf ball.
Like a golf ball, but long-ish.
Okay.
That's what fingerlings
one
are.
One of my golf balls.
Exactly. And you can find those in a lot of catalogs, too. And then just one last thing. Pine Tree Garden Seeds has this great look, Bob. They have categories in their seed catalog for food, Like Asian vegetables.
Oh.
Continental vegetables.
Well, Hoosier vegetables.
Middle Eastern vegetables. Oh, Latin American vegetables.
Wow.
So, great, you know, idea. If you want to get really creative, you can have Pine Trees
pine tree.
Direct you. All right?
I'll tell Janet.
There you have it. All right. All right. We'll be doing questions again here pretty soon as we start to warm up. And, of course, you can get a hold of us in a couple of different ways if you have some.
Visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org. Call us at 502-814-8246 or send us a Valentine's Day card at 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202.
All right, Bob, it's a plant story day. What do you have for us?
In keeping with the show.
Yes.
It's Asclepias.
Asclepias.
Which is?
Butterfly weed.
You got it, babe. And we're not going to talk a whole lot about the butterfly weed itself because we've had earlier guests on the show talking about that. Other than the fact that it's got this milky sap is why it's called the butterfly weed. Mm-hmm. It's somewhat toxic depending on the plant and the soil it's grown in. And it's kind of fun. The monarch butterflies eat it, which makes them poisonous to their predators. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of cool how it works through history. But it's one of those poisonous plants that somehow got used as medicine in the ancient days.
A little bit or too much, yeah, sort right. of like alcohol, right?
Yeah, not necessarily as population control. Uh-huh. I guess, you know, it worked or didn't work. Who uh-huh. knows? But it was used for pleurisy, pneumonia, and, of course, fevers, asthma, and as a dressing for wounds and ulcers.
Uh-huh. And, well, maybe it depends on what part of the plant you
use. Exactly, and if you cooked it or not. Yeah. You can cook it and actually eat it uh-huh. and so forth. There's a lot of different cultivars, and the most common is the one in the wild is the Asclepias syrica, mm-hmm. which was a name given by Linnaeus. Syrica because he thought it was from Syria.
Syrica, okay. Yeah. That's why. Uh-huh.
Right. And Asclepias because he wanted to name it in honor of the Greek god of medicine, whose uh-huh. name was something like Aesculapius, uh-huh. which became Asclepias.
I see.
So he was the Greek god of medicine uh-huh. with a classically Greek bloody history. Asclepius was the son of Apollo and a woman named Coronis. She was killed for being unfaithful to Apollo, but before she died, her unborn child was rescued from her womb. For that, he got the name Asclepius, which is Greek to cut open.
Huh.
Them Greeks, man.
No kidding.
He had six daughters, one named Hygieia for hygiene.
Sure.
And one named Panacea.
Huh.
As an
for
all-caring.
Panacea.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
The original Hippocratic Oath began, I swear by Apollo, the physician, and by Asclepius, and by Hygieia, and Panacea, and all the gods.
Huh, interesting.
Yep. Zeus later killed Asclepius with a thunderbolt because he developed a bad habit of raising people from the dead and collecting gold for it.
Oh, Zeus, always corrupt. Those yeah. Greek gods.
He had no sense of humor. There was a whole cult that followed Asclepius around after he died. One of them believed in the liberal use of wine to cure an illness, mm-hmm. or at least let you forget it.
Yeah.
The other was a practice where sick people would visit designated sanctuaries where non-venomous snakes were allowed to crawl around on the floor, huh. or sacred dogs were allowed to lick their wounds.
Mm.
Yeah. Hygiene indeed.
Yeah.
Comes with a poem. So much has medicine done to us, just to honor old Asclepius. So much in thought and fact indeed that lives today in our milkweed. We see his face across meadows fine as butterflies swarm in bright sunshine, hiding all sense of foreboding and dread and raising up clients from the dead. But remember this as meadows you walk, engaged in light and frivolous talk. The landscape is fraught with legends and lies, and much of it borne by the butterflies.
Uh-huh. Very good.
Asclepias.
Asclepias, the butterfly weed. Yeah. Yep. As Bob said, there are a whole bunch of different species, so some butterflies like more than others, right?
Yep.
All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, we get ready for the Great Backyard Bird Count in February.
Homegrown is produced by that gentle radio healer, Brad Yost, in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.